Welcome to today's edition of Time in the Vineyard with pastor teacher Jeff Torring. Today's broadcast is being brought to you from the pulpit of Liberty Valley Church, Northfield, Ohio.
Before we get to Psalm 89, I would like to just spend a few minutes in the pastoral epistle, 2 Timothy, in chapter 3. Paul is writing to his son in the faith, young preacher Timothy, and he's giving him some admonitions. And in chapter 3, he tells him that know also that in the last days perilous times shall come. And he goes through a list of some of the things that he describes within these perilous times. A treachery of things that take place, and depending on how I feel, I suppose, I think I'm pretty sure that unfortunately some of the descriptions that he's giving in this chapter are actually directed towards believers or so-called believers in the last days, which makes the times even more perilous. If some of these are descriptive of believers, what shall the uncircumcised be? As we move into it in verse 13, he says, evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. But, Timothy, I want you to continue with the things that you have learned, that thou hast been taught and assured of, knowing of whom thou hast learned them. Of course, Paul being one of them, his preacher, his apostle. But he goes back even further, and he says that from a child thou hast known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make thee wise unto salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. Of course, we know that Lois and Eunice, his grandmother and his mother, were important for that, and we need to be aware of that. But not only did they just teach them Bible stories, his mom and grandmother and the apostle spent a lot of time teaching doctrine. I bump into quite a few people that are believers that attend different churches, and I know you do too. But it seems as though, and that this is kind of running just right, that to talk about things that are doctrinal are difficult. It's becoming more, I guess, and more difficult to have a cup of coffee and discuss things that are not just frivolous or superficial biblical things at that, but to get into something doctrinal, have an eschatological conversation. Why are you this? Why is your position this? Or why is it not? It is definitely becoming more difficult. And I think that that is one of the reasons why we have chapter 3 of 2 Timothy. Because the doctrines, the main doctrines of the faith, are becoming obscure. They're not as familiar. And so he tells them in verse 16, all scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine. That we need to know these things. That we have to understand why we believe, what we believe, and where our doctrinal position would be. So, he says in verse 17, that the man of God may be perfect, more mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. So doctrine is important. Otherwise, we are not then thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Because the doctrines that we hold will dictate how we live and who we are. If we have a big God, then we understand that we live differently. We may try to accomplish more if God is a big God. I had a conversation with a gentleman the other day who's endeavoring to start a building project. And so he came here and we discussed some things. And I said, look, if you're looking to do this, Deacon told me in the very beginning, this is how you eat an elephant, one bite at a time. And you better have a big God. So if you want to have big things, if you want to accomplish big things for God, then we have to have a big God. And so your theology does come out in a day-to-day living. Whether you like it or not, it does come out. And so these doctrines that he's telling us, so that the man of God may be perfect, thoroughly furnished. So he says, I charge thee before God, before the Lord Jesus Christ the King, who shall sit and judge the quick and the dead at his appearing at his coming. Preach the word. Preach it. Be instant, in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all long suffering and doctrine. The doctrines of the faith have to be a part of our teachings. Because, he says, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine. When we come back to Psalm 89, we see some of this take place. The psalmist here is explaining doctrine. And he's doing it in a song or a poem, part of the Psalter, I'm sure recited and sung in the temple, but I think, according to verse 1, it's sung elsewhere. He says in verse 1 of the psalm, "I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever." Mercy. "With my mouth will I make known thy faithfulness to all generations." So he's singing it to the elderly, to the young, to his age, downright to babies. And he's singing of mercy. He's rehearsing, he's declaring from the wealth of doctrine that he has within. He has these doctrines that he is singing about are in his heart, and from the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so through all the years of his life, this catalog has been filled, his mind has been filled with doctrine that some people may not think is important, but he does, and we're going to see why it is important. And he starts out with mercy. Now, mercy is an interesting topic to start out with. And I can remember the most intricate part. Do you remember before you were saved when God was forming you? And now when you look back, you realize he clearly was forming me back then. And I wasn't even converted. But you can see some of the spiritual foundations almost that he was giving to us beforehand. I can remember vividly, exactly as if it was yesterday, learning the importance of mercy. I was friends with older guys, and one in particular was just a mountain of a man. I mean, just a big guy. I saw him take down 4 or 5 guys at one time, and we knew 2 other kids that were pretty boys. In fact, one of them decided he was going to be a model. At least that's what his goal was. But the one guy would pick terribly on the other, who was younger. I mean, terribly picked on him. And then, of course, as life went on, a couple years later, he ended up spending a couple years on vacation in prison. And he came out a different person. The first thing that he did is he found that guy who picked on him. And he beat him. And he was going to be a model. And he knew it. So he took away his beauty. And he just beat and beat and beat and beat. It's interesting because the conversation that I overheard of the larger guys, the guys that were older than me, there has to come a time, even if we're beating someone down, when you have to show mercy. He went too far. We need as men to understand mercy. This is coming from a lost, uncircumcised Philistine. But I never forgot it. It's a biblical principle that here the psalmist is talking about. He says, "I will sing of the mercy." The mercies, plural, of the Lord. The Lord is the big guy. The Lord is terrible. In the literal sense, the Lord our God is a terrible God. So he's going to sing of the mercies that come from the Lord. "My mouth I will make known thy faithfulness to all generations. For I have said, mercy shall be built up forever." And so what he does is he's got this illustration that he's starting to paint. Because when he writes mercy, it shall be built. Mercy is built as a bulwark, brick upon brick, brick upon brick, block and stone, precept upon precept, line upon line. He's saying that this mercy, it shall be built. It's continuously built. There was mercy when you were born from your mother's womb that you didn't come out with the cord wrapped around your neck. There was mercy in that. There was mercy that we lived through the birthing process. And so that stone there in the very beginning was laid, and there was larger stones, and the mercy was built upon brick, block upon block. And so the mercy becomes stronger, and the wall becomes stronger as we learn. It's as a solid as stone walls, is what he is saying. This mercy, it shall be built up forever. "Thy faithfulness shalt thou establish in the very heavens." And then look what he does is he immediately transfers to doctrine. The bedrock He says, I have made. Now here, some say that God is actually speaking through the psalmist, but I don't believe so. I think he's just quoting God. And we do this in our prayers. You can remind God of things that he has said and then hold him accountable in our life. You said this. Therefore, I'm holding you accountable as God who never lies to do this for me in our life. And so what he does is he quotes God, and what he does is he pulls out the bedrock of this brick building, built by built, brick by brick. I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have sworn unto David my servant. So he's quoting the Almighty concerning the Davidic covenant. Now ask yourself, can I explain what the Davidic covenant is, if somebody were to ask? This is doctrine. This is what we need to do. We need to be learning and being able to teach in a way, even as he brings out the Davidic covenant. And so what he does is he finds this covenant is engraven within the brickwork and the bulwarks of this. He says, look, part of the Davidic covenant is unto David, thy seed will I establish forever. And again, build up thy throne. And so you see this picture of brick by brick being illustrated to all generations. Selah, think on this. Then upon further review within his heart, the catalog opens up further and he reviews some of the things of the Lord. And so he begins to exalt the Lord. For who, in verse 6, in the heaven can be compared unto the Lord? So he's thinking, who among the sons of the mighty can be likened unto the Lord? And many often think that when he's talking of the sons of the mighty here, that he's talking of angelic beings. He's talking of possibly angels. So you think, 2 Kings, we're told that one angel came down and killed 185,000 men. One angel, like nothing. Killed them all. But he says, in the heavens, though, even with the sons of the mighty, angels like that, who is like you? God is a frightening God. He is a terrible God, meaning terror. He's a fright. He's dreadful. Who in the heavens is like you? Not even the sons of the mighty. God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints, and to be had in reverence of all them that are about him. This goes to music, because this is talking of the assembly of the saints. If you like faster music, which I do, and I know some of you do, I appreciate that. And so we choose music for worship, sometimes that is faster and more upbeat. And I appreciate that, and it ministers to all of us. But I know that there are some who do not like the slower music. There are some that don't like the old hymns, and they will consistently tell someone that we need to have more upbeat music. We need to have more contemporary music. We need to have this. And then sometimes I listen to it, and you may be correct. But if you can't appreciate slow, solemn, sacred music along with the fast music, then you have a problem. You're immature, and you need to grow. Because this is what he is saying. Look, in the sanctuary of the times, in the assembly of the saints, it says he is to be had in reverence of all them about him. He is to be greatly feared in the assembly of the saints. So we rehearsed one song, and the piano player, she says, it's kind of like a dirge. I said, exactly, that's exactly what I'm going for. He's greatly to be feared. O Lord, O God of hosts, who is strong, Lord, like unto you, or to thy faithfulness round about thee? Thou rulest the raging of the sea. When the waves thereof arise, you can still them. We know that Jesus walked on water. He said, peace, be still. And the waves were stilled. But the picture here is far more than that. He is talking of the raging sea. About 20 years ago, I was on a smaller cruise ship, and we were in the tail end of a hurricane. The waves, the swells of the ocean were 60-foot swells. I mean, the boat was like the SS Minnow. Everything was falling. There was no dishes on the carts. And this is a cruise ship. But this is horror. We're talking about the magnitude of God, the raging sea. He's able not only to stop the wind, but to still the sea. And he goes on and he exalts the things of the Lord, and most of them you can just read in your own pleasure. But notice when you come down to verse 19, he says, "Then thou spakest in a vision to thy Holy One, and saidst, I have laid help upon one that is mighty. I have exalted one chosen out of the people. I have found David my servant." He comes back to the brick wall. He's coming back to the Davidic covenant again. He returns to this brickwork. And another psalm says, "Consider the bulwarks. Consider the gates of the wall." If you stand outside a city that is of this time, even if you go to the Middle East, when there are still cities that are in a citadel of wall, it is majestic to look at these things. They are thick walls that are high, and it looks and it brings you back to the times of David. And what he is saying here is, look at that. The psalmist is intrigued by the brickwork. So he speaks of it again, but this time it's a very skilled mason. It's the master builder. He takes special note because at this point he says he's speaking in a vision about this Holy One. And we know that he's talking of David, but he's also then beginning to see glimpses of the Son of David, the good king and the great king. He says in 20, look at it. "I have found David my servant. With my holy oil have I anointed him. With whom my hand shall be established. Mine arm shall strengthen him. The enemy shall not exact upon him, nor the son of wickedness afflict him. I will beat down his foes before his face, plague them with that hate him. But my faithfulness and my mercy shall be with him, and in my name shall his horn be exalted. I will set his hand also in the sea, and his right hand in the rivers. He shall cry unto me, Thou art my Father, my God, and the rock, and the salvation." And he goes through, and you can see the psalmist is exalting God. He's saying, "God, you are great and powerful." And like he talks about the mountains of Hermon and all these things that are majestic, and how God is so great and so wonderful that he's just singing this song. It's a song of praise. It's a song of jubilee. It's a song of all the different doctrines that he knows. Look at it. He says, verse 29, "His seed, the family of David, his seed also will I make to endure forever, and his throne as the days of heaven." This is going to last forever. Of course, there's a human element involved in the covenant. "If his children forsake my law and walk not in his judgments, if they break my statutes and keep not my commandments, then will I visit their transgression with a rod and their iniquity with stripes." There will be punishment. Nevertheless, don't you like the nevertheless? The security that is involved? "Nevertheless, my loving kindness will I not utterly take from him, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail. My covenant," again, he's talking that he is teaching in this song. He is a covenant-keeping God. He is teaching the Davidic covenant. He wants them to know that this Davidic covenant is everlasting. If you misbehave, yes, I will hit you with stripes and I'll hit you with the rod. But it doesn't mean I don't love you. It means that I'm coming for you for correction. But nevertheless, even if you're terrible, we have the book of Kings. And we have seen very, very wicked kings, have we not? Nevertheless, my covenant will stand. Jeremiah talks of this Davidic covenant, and he said, "Hey, look, that covenant stands as long as the moon stays in the sky and the sun comes up in the east. Nevertheless, my loving kindness will I not utterly take from him, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail." Okay? Verse 34, "My covenant will I not break, nor alter the thing that has gone out of my lips." I won't even alter it, because once I have sworn by my holiness that I will not lie unto David. And again, he's beating this drum. And he's beating it and beating it and beating it. Okay, I got it. Verse 36, "His seed shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me. It shall be established forever as the moon and as the faithful witness in the heaven." Selah, think on this for a minute, because, verse 38, we have a but. But. says all these things. But thou hast cast off and abhorred. Thou hast been wroth with thine anointed. Look at verse 39. Thou hast made void the covenant of thy servant. Thou hast profaned his crown by casting it to the ground. And now, after reading the first 38 verses of the psalm, doesn't it seem odd to you? I mean, he's beating the drum. It will last forever. It will last forever. It will last forever. It will last forever. And then we have this but. But you have made void the covenant. One would say, is this possible then? Can this be? Just from what we've learned from this psalm alone, someone would have to say here at this point of the psalm, can this be? And then we realize, oh my gosh, this is an exilic psalm. This is a psalm of exile or a post-exile psalm. He has been singing this lovely, joyous song of God's faithfulness and mercy and love and the covenant-keeping God, covenant-keeping God, covenant-keeping God. And now we realize the Babylonians have probably already came and wiped them out. He is singing this song of joy and of covenant in the midst of horror. We realize, while he sings this, the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and the gates thereof are burned with fire. But can it be? Does God break his covenant? Is it really made void? Did the stars fall from the skies, brother? Did the moon fall? Did the sun, does it lose its luster? Because that's what God said, right? And listen, if we're going to base our life on this book, we better believe it. And I don't mean just say it. I mean, believe it. Yes, we may screw up and we may be chastened, but if this is what we live on, this is it. This is our whole everything that we believe. This is everything of everything, is the book. And if the book isn't trustworthy, then we're men most miserable. If he said, I will never break my covenant, and then says a little bit later, well, I've broken my covenant, then how can we trust anything at all? How do we know we're even saved? How do we know we're not all trucking our way down to the pit? Well, look what he does. Thou hast broken down all his hedges. Thou hast brought his strongholds to ruin. The beautiful city of David is in ruin. All that pass by spoil him. They take everything. They're robbing them blind. He is a reproach to his neighbors. Thou hast set up the right hand of his adversaries. This is coming from God. Verse 43, thou hast also turned the edge of his sword and hast not made him to stand in battle. There's no tough guys around here. Thou hast made his glory to cease and cast his throne down to the ground. The days of his youth hast thou shortened. Thou hast covered him with shame. Think on this. And in verse 43:6, he asks the question. Look at verse 46. How long, Lord? How long wilt thou hide thyself forever? Shall thy wrath burn like fire? Well, that's a good question. Something interesting right after that, because I think what happens is verse 46 is like self-inflection. He stops and he doesn't say this out loud, but he says it in his heart. How long? Why does he say how long? Because he knows the covenant really is not made void. It's not an if. How long? How long are we going to be here? How long are we going to continue like this? How long? We know there's a finishing point because you have told us. So how long, Lord, will you be the God that hides yourself? Now look what he says in 47. The most interesting thing, he tells the Lord, Remember how short my time is. What he's saying there is, I want to see something happen in my lifetime. This could last a long time. How long, O Lord, I don't know. But you promised that the throne would last forever. And it's a covenant-keeping God, so I know that you will return. But how long shall we wait? And what he is saying in his heart is, remember, God, that I don't live very long, and I want to see it in my lifetime. That begs the question then, doesn't it? How bad do you want to see it? You want to see something happen big? Because remember, this is the human element. Why did the Babylonians come? Because of humans. If you don't do what I tell you, I'll hit you with stripes and with a rod. But if you do what I tell you, then the blessings will come. So the question that he is asking is, how long will this take? Well, that depends on what we do, doesn't it? Now, I'm not saying that we can disrupt or thwart the prophetical calendar of the Almighty with the Jews. But I mean us as a king in kingdoms, us as Christians, who are part of the seed of David that shall be part of this covenant, because we have been adopted into the family. No, we're not Jews, but we are adopted into the family of Jews. Therefore, we are part of this covenant as well. Therefore, how long, O Lord, till you return? Well, how long do you want to do? How long shall this take place? Remember, my time is short, and I would like to see it in my lifetime. Well, that depends on how much you really want to see it. We are his hands and his feet, aren't we? How else does the Lord work? You want something to happen in your lifetime? How bad do you want it? You willing to give it all up? Because you may have to. So how bad do you want it? Remember how short my time is, God. We have 12 boys upstairs that are all dressed in suits with black ties. It's interesting, isn't it? The invitation went out to all the boys, and we end up with a number of the apostles. Wouldn't that be something?
You've been listening to Time in the Vineyard with pastor-teacher Jeff Turing. Today's broadcast was brought to you from the pulpit of Liberty Valley Church, Northfield, Ohio. For more information, you can call the church at 330-554-7606 or check us out on the web at libertyvalleychurch.org. That's libertyvalleychurch.org.